This is the very first event of the Wheeler Institute for Business and Development, and we are looking forward in the next years to promote cutting-edge research on the intersection of business and development, further expand our portfolio of experiential learning that we do programs in Johannesburg, in Lima, in many parts of the world, and we plan to expand this, this process, and this is one of the visions of the Wheeler Institute. And at the same time, we want to bring engagement and bring awareness of some of the most cutting-edge problems that the world is being faced. And we couldn't come up with a better presenter and speaker for the very first event than Raj Chetty. So thank you very much.
So thanks so much for the warm introduction. It's a pleasure to be here, especially for this inaugural event. I appreciate you setting up this center, and I hope it'll do great things going forward. So I'm going to talk today about improving equality of opportunity, which is a big, complicated topic, and I'm going to talk about it from the perspective of how we can use big data or modern administrative data to really think about these issues at a very granular level. But I want to start at a big picture level by talking about the idea of the American dream, which is a complicated concept that means different things to different people. But let's distill it for simplicity to a statistic that we can measure systematically in the data, which is the chance that a child born to parents in the bottom fifth of the income distribution makes the leap to the top fifth of the income distribution. So this is the classic rags to riches, Horatio Alger version of the American dream, what people think America is kind of known for as a land of opportunity. So how common is it that in fact a child can make this climb from the bottom to the top? So here are some statistics on that for the United States and other countries for which we have comparable data. In the US, kids born to parents in the bottom fifth of the income distribution have a 7.5% chance of reaching the top fifth of the income distribution. That compares with 9% here in the United Kingdom, 11.7% in Denmark, 13.5% in Canada. Now, when people look at these statistics, sometimes they initially react by saying, oh, even in Canada, it looks like your odds of success aren't all that high, right? Only a 13.5% chance of making it in some sense. Now, you have to remember, of course, that no matter what you do, you can't have more than 20% of people in the top 20%, right? And so to make that a little bit more precise, these are conditional probabilities. So theoretically, it's possible that 100% of people who start out in the bottom 20% could end up in the top 20%. But in order for that to be the case, it would actually have to be true that for people born to higher income families, they're less likely to make it to the top. So if you make the reasonable assumption that we're never going to live in a society where your odds of succeeding are negatively related to your parent income, which I think is a reasonable premise, then the upper bound that the statistic could plausibly be is 20%. And so relative to that maximum of 20%, these are actually quite large differences in rates of upward mobility, rates of social mobility. The way I think about it is that in some sense, your chances of achieving the American dream of moving up are twice as high if you're growing up in Canada rather than the United States. Now, motivated by these kinds of issues, there's growing concern in the US, and I think equally well in the UK. There's less data in the UK at the moment, which is something that I think could be fixed and should be fixed. But as best we can tell, the UK and US look somewhat similar on this dimension. There's a concern that these countries are no longer really a land of opportunity for people growing up in low-income families. And so motivated by that, my colleagues and I are in what we're calling the Equality of Opportunity Project, are just studying this very big picture question of how can we increase social mobility. And so our approach has some broad themes, which I'll bring out through a series of specific studies in this talk. The first is to draw upon big data, to use the Silicon Valley buzzword, to study how to increase upward mobility. So much as you hear about large data sets in the private sector being used to improve products offered by companies like Amazon or Google, analogously, I think a very important trend in economics is the use of such data, typically from government sources, but increasingly from places like Facebook or Twitter and so on, to tackle social and economic policy questions. And so I'll illustrate how we do that in various ways in this talk. Second, the approach we take is very broad in terms of the set of mechanisms and interventions we consider. So rather than coming at this from a particular methodological perspective, like we're only going to think about education, we actually think about a range of issues from housing policy to education to other things from childhood to adulthood. And so you'll see a span of different possibilities that you might want to think about, because I really think this is a multifaceted problem that doesn't just boil down to one class of interventions. And third, much of what we do starts from a focus on geographic variation. The fact that there are very sharp differences in kids' chances of climbing the income ladder across areas, even within countries. And so the data that I'm going to show you today is primarily from the United States, but I'll talk about in the end how I think we can do analogous work in other countries. And Elias is doing analogous work, in fact, in Africa, and there are other people doing similar work in Canada and so forth. So I think a lot of the results that I'm going to talk about here, while they're from American data, can be potentially transported to the UK, or at least similar analysis can be done here. So let's start by looking at the data within America, where we use information from tax returns covering about 10 million kids. So basically all the kids born in America in the early 1980s, we're able to link them to their parents using data from tax returns and look at the geography of upward mobility within the United States. So similar measures of upward mobility that I was thinking about across countries before, let's now look at that within America. So what we're doing here is assigning kids to locations within the United States metro areas based on where they grew up. And then we're looking here at a very simple statistic, which is if you grow up in a relatively low-income family, a family at the 25th percentile of the parental income distribution, that's a family making about $25,000 a year, what is your own income when you're around 30 years old on average? What's your own household income? And the map is colored so that green colors represent areas with higher levels of upward mobility, where you see low-income kids doing well in absolute terms, and red represent areas with lower levels of upward mobility. So you can see in the darkest green colors, you have mean incomes of $43,000 a year. In the darkest red colors, mean incomes of $26,000 a year. This is conditional on starting at the same place, importantly, right? So this difference of nearly a factor of two in your mean income is an enormous difference in children's prospects and life outcomes in general. And so, you know, you can see the broad geographic patterns for yourself. The center of the country, for example, has very high rates of upward mobility. Much of the Southeast, places like Atlanta, Georgia, Charlotte, North Carolina, have very low levels of upward mobility. Those patterns, you know, at some level, they might seem intuitive that the Southeast has lower levels of upward mobility, but then you think about it a little bit more carefully, you might know Atlanta is one of the cities with the highest rates of job growth in the United States. It's the engine of jobs in America. Yet it's surprising if you're a poor kid growing up in Atlanta, you don't have very good prospects in terms of climbing the income ladder. And in fact, when you look at the data in a more detailed way, you see that Atlanta is essentially outsourcing its talent production. Lots of people move to Atlanta to get good jobs, but the low-income kids who are growing up in Atlanta itself don't end up doing particularly well. And so, you know, the patterns here, I think, are important in trying to understand, you know, why there's such sharp differences in rates of upward mobility across places. So in this big map, your eye naturally gravitates to this very broad regional variation between the middle of the country, the coasts, and so forth, which look better. Turns out, though, that if you zoom in, so let's take one example, let's zoom into the New York City metro area and look at the data now by county in New York, which corresponds to the different boroughs in New York City, so like Manhattan, Queens, and so forth. What you see is that there continues to be significant variation, even at a much more local level. And so we continue to see this in our ongoing research. I don't have this data publicly available yet, but we're going down to the census tract level, which are units of 4,000 people each. So think about almost the block level, and you continue to see, you know, substantial variation even within a given town across different neighborhoods. And so you can see here, take the New York example, a low-income kid growing up in Manhattan, so that would typically be a place like Harlem if you're a low-income family in Manhattan, you're earning $32,000 a year. But then if you go over to Queens, just nearby, it's a mean income of $40,000 a year, again, conditional on growing up in family with the same level of income. And so naturally, the question in light of the sort of sharp variation in rates of upward mobility at fine geographies is, why does upward mobility vary so much across areas? That's of interest to us as academics in understanding what the mechanisms are driving these differences. And it's of interest to policymakers who want to figure out how you might replicate the successes of some of the green-colored areas on the map elsewhere in the country. So I'm going to show you a set of results trying to answer this question, and there's much that remains to be learned about why upward mobility varies across areas and what we can ultimately do to change upward mobility. Let me start by establishing a first set of results showing that most of the variation in upward mobility is caused by differences in childhood environment. So there are two key words. The first is the word caused. That is, it's actually about the causal effect of growing up in different places. It's not just that the type of people who grow up in Queens are different from the type of people who grow up in Manhattan. If you take a given child and put that child in Queens instead of Manhattan, you see different outcomes for that given child. And the second is that this is about childhood environment. So you might have had, you know, one of the first hypotheses we had is maybe this is about differences in the types of jobs that are available in different areas or differences in labor market conditions. But in fact, what you see is that it really seems to be about differences in what's going on while you're growing up. Okay, and so the way I'm going to demonstrate that is from a study we've done of 7 million families that move across areas within the United States. Again, exploiting the power of having these data sets that cover essentially the entire U.S. population. And so rather than getting into the econometric and statistical details of that study, I'm going to summarize what we find with a simple example. So let's say we take a set of kids who start out in Manhattan, which we saw has relatively low rates of upward mobility, low outcomes for kids growing up in low-income families compared to surrounding areas in New York. Okay, and so we saw in particular that kids who grow up in Manhattan from birth earn about $32,000 on average when we measure their incomes at age 30. So now what I want to do is think about a set of kids who move from Manhattan to Queens, whereas we saw kids who grow up there from birth tend to have better outcomes. And what I want to do is think about kids whose parents moved when they were at different ages. So let's start by thinking about children who move when they were exactly 2 years old from Manhattan to Queens. And so what we do in this analysis is track those kids forward 28 years and measure their own earnings when they are age 30. And what you can see is that these children are earning on average about $37,000. When they are 30 years old. Okay, so that's for the kids who move when they're exactly two. Now let's repeat that analysis for kids who move when they're 3, 4, 5, and so on. And what you see is a very clear declining pattern. The later you make that move from Manhattan to Queens, the less of a gain you get. If you move by the time you're in your early 20s, you get essentially no gain at all. And if you move after that point, the relationship is completely flat. So what do you see from this analysis? I think there are three key takeaways. The first is that where you grow up really matters. It's not just that the kids who live in Manhattan are different from the kids who live in Queens. You take a given child and move that child from Manhattan to Queens, you see very different outcomes. I see that as a very encouraging result because it shows that this problem is actually changeable. You can actually meaningfully change people's outcomes through a simple move a few miles away. Not to say that that's the right policy solution to be moving people to different areas necessarily, but it just shows you that this is a malleable thing, which I think is at least a good place to start. Second, what you can see here is that what really seems to matter is childhood environment rather than conditions in adulthood. You see in these data and other experimental data that we've looked at that if you have people move to different areas as adults, it doesn't really have much of an impact on their outcomes. It's really about what's going on in your childhood. And the third thing that you see is that every extra year of exposure to a better environment adds up to better outcomes in the long run. So you can see that if you get to a better environment, in this case, Queens instead of Manhattan, at age 8 instead of 9 or 15 instead of 16, there's an incremental impact for every extra year of exposure. The relationship looks somewhat concave, meaning that the slope is steeper in the teenage years rather than in the early years. And so what that, I think, is telling us is that the neighborhood environment actually seems to matter more around your teenage years than it does at the very earliest years, which I think is an interesting result from a policy perspective because, as many of you will know, there's a lot of discussion about the importance of early childhood intervention at the moment. And while we think early childhood intervention can be extremely valuable, what these data show you is that being in a better environment while you're a teenager or an adolescent is equally, if not more important in terms of neighborhood conditions. Now, one just quick note for the economists in the audience, those who are interested in, you know, how do we make a causal claim here? The key assumption we're making is that the types of families who move when kids are young versus when kids are older are similar to each other. So the experiment here, the identification assumption, is that there's a similarity in the potential outcomes of children who move when they're young and when they're old. So you might worry, maybe the people who move when they're relatively young are from more affluent families, more educated families. Maybe it's not an apples to apples comparison when you look at kids who move when they're young and old. So we do a number of tests to try to address that sort of concern. Let me give you one example. So you can look at siblings within a family and compare their outcomes. Let's say you take a family that moves with a 7-year-old and a 13-year-old. And remarkably, if you do exactly the same analysis looking at siblings, you get exactly the same picture. The 7-year-old kid does better than the 13-year-old kid, exactly in proportion to that 6-year age gap, very similar to the pattern that I'm showing you here. So that, you know, takes out the possibility that it's different types of families moving when it's young versus old. So you can do many things along those lines that have led us and many others to be convinced that neighborhoods really have a causal effect on rates of upward mobility. Okay, great. So naturally, your next question might be, okay, so now we've established that your chances of climbing the income ladder seem to depend greatly on where you grow up. So what is the recipe for success in places that have high rates of upward mobility that were in the green colors on the map relative to the places in the red colors? If we could figure out what that recipe is, we could presumably replicate that elsewhere in the US, perhaps in other countries and so forth. Now, figuring out what that recipe for success is incredibly challenging. It's something that we are continuing to work on, many people are working on. What I'm going to do here is something simpler. I'm going to correlate these differences in upward mobility across areas with various characteristics that economists and sociologists have thought about over the years. And so for simplicity, we've looked at a variety of different factors in these correlations. I'm going to summarize what we find by focusing on the 5 strongest correlates that we've identified. Okay, and so the first one is residential segregation. We find that places that are less residentially segregated by race or by income tend to have higher rates of upward mobility. Now, there are many different ways in which you can measure residential segregation from a statistical point of view. It turns out the patterns here are so stark that you can just see them visually, and it doesn't really matter what statistic you use. So let me give you a couple examples. So let's go back to Atlanta, Georgia, which, as I pointed out, was one of the places with the lowest levels of upward mobility in the US. So this map here depicts racial segregation in the Atlanta metro area. The way it's constructed is every person in Atlanta using census data is represented by a dot, and the dots are colored so that whites are blue, blacks are green, Asians are red, and Hispanics are orange. So you can see immediately, it doesn't matter how you measure it, it's obvious Atlanta is an incredibly segregated city. The blacks live in a completely different part of the city relative to white Americans in Atlanta. And so cities that look like this in terms of residential structure, where people are completely separated from each other, tend to have the lowest levels of upward mobility in the United States. Now, why exactly is that? It could be about social interaction that matters, that's not happening when you have this kind of rigid structure. It could also be about other mechanisms. So if you think about funding for public schools, for example, if you live in a very segregated area, minorities and lower income people, because schools are financed using a local tax base in the US, using local property taxes, you're gonna have a more poorly funded school if you live in a very segregated city as a low income kid, relative to if you live in a more integrated city. So we don't know exactly what the mechanism is yet that drives this correlation, but that's one very strong pattern in the data, that more segregated cities have low levels of upward mobility. Now, interestingly, if you look as a contrast at Sacramento, California, which is a city with relatively high levels of upward mobility, you can see Sacramento, it has the same minority share as Atlanta, the same fraction of blacks and Hispanics as Atlanta, but you can see the colors are much more interspersed here than what you saw in Atlanta. They're not perfectly integrated by any means, but it's much more integrated, and corresponding to that, cities that look like this in terms of residential structure tend to have high levels of upward mobility. So that's one strong pattern in the data, that segregation is strongly associated with these differences in mobility. Now, going a little bit more quickly through the other factors, we find that places with a larger middle class, so more people between the 25th and 75th percentile of the national income distribution, tend to have higher levels of mobility across generations. So why is this important? It suggests that there could be a link between inequality within a generation and your ability to climb the income ladder across generations. And as we live in an era of growing income inequality, insofar as there's a causal relationship between those two things, we might be concerned that as we have growing inequality, we might have lower chances for kids to climb the income ladder as well, which would potentially be quite concerning. The third and fourth factors I'm going to talk about come more from the sociology literature. We find that places with more stable family structures, so more two-parent families, for instance, tend to have higher levels of upward mobility. Interestingly, this actually turns out to be the single strongest correlation in the data. The fraction of two-parent families in an area is incredibly strongly predictive of differences in mobility. Now, in thinking about that correlation, the first explanation that might come to your mind is that growing up in a two-parent household, you know, might be beneficial for children relative to growing up in a single-parent household. And while that is a little bit of what's going on, that's actually not the key driver of the correlation. And the way that you can see that is if you look at a set of kids whose own parents are married, so only look at kids who are growing up in two-parent families, and compare kids who grow up in an area with a lot of single parents versus kids who grow up in an area with a lot of two-parent families, you continue to find the same correlation. So in other words, even if my own parents are married, but I grow up in an area with a lot of single parents, I'm less likely to climb the income ladder, which shows you that it's not literally about whether my own parents are married or not. It's again picking up some community level factor, we don't know exactly what, that's associated with kids' long-term outcomes. The fourth factor is a little bit related to that. It's the idea of social capital, popularized in a well-known book by Bob Putnam at Harvard called Bowling Alone, which some of you might know. And so the way I think about social capital is the old adage that it takes a village to raise a child. Will someone else help you out even if you're not doing well? In the US, a city thought to have a lot of social capital, the canonical example is Salt Lake City with the Mormon Church. It's thought to be a place with a lot of social capital, correspondingly has very high levels of social mobility. Now, measuring some of these things is quite challenging. The reason I actually mentioned Bob Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, is that the reason he used that title is he used bowling alleys, the presence of bowling alleys, and in particular, whether people were bowling alone as a proxy for social capital in an area. Now, to my amazement, the number of bowling alleys is actually very highly correlated with these differences in mobility that I've been showing you here. The reason I mentioned that, though, is an important caveat to everything that I'm showing you on this slide, is that these are correlations rather than causal effects. So where you can see that is, you know, I'd be quite surprised if the policy solution here is that we need to build more bowling alleys to increase social mobility, right? So you should look at these more as clues about what might matter rather than the mechanisms in terms of what we need to manipulate through policy in order to get better outcomes. Now, the fifth case, which is quite intuitive, places with higher quality primary and secondary education tend to have higher levels of mobility. There's a large body of evidence suggesting that's not just true correlationally. There are strong causal effects of the quality of education on kids' long-term outcomes. And so I want to show you a little bit of that type of work, which has been done in our research team, but many others as well. And I'm going to give you one quick example of that illustrates how you can use these types of data to get more precisely at mechanisms and what types of policy changes might actually have an impact. So let's talk a little bit about education policy in more detail. Not because I think that's the most important thing on that list of five factors, it's the one that we happen to have been able to study in some more detail. So how can we use big data to study teachers' impact? So in the next study that I'm going to talk about, we get data from the New York City School District, where we get information on 2.5 million kids who attended New York City public schools between 1989 and 2009. Over that period, they wrote 18 million tests. We link that data to the tax records that I was working with for the first part of the analysis that I've been showing you, so that you can ask a question like, how does your third grade teacher affect how much you're earning when you're 30 years old? Because you've linked the New York City School District data to the tax data, right? And so you can look at things like earnings, college attendance, teenage birth, because lots of things get measured in US tax records. Okay, so in order to show you that teacher quality has some impact on children's later life outcomes, I first need to have a measure of teacher quality that I'm gonna work with. And so the measure I'm gonna focus on here is one that is of great policy relevance in the US, which are test score-based metrics. And my understanding is there's discussion of these kinds of measures here in the UK as well. And so, you know, one very prominent measure of teacher quality are what are called teacher value-added measures. So the idea of these measures is how much, you're basically trying to measure how much a teacher raises his or her students' test scores on average. So let me give you a simple example of how you compute a value-added measure. Let's say I'm a fourth grade teacher. We take my students' test scores on average at the end of fourth grade, minus their test scores on average at the beginning of fourth grade. And if that number is very positive, we'd say I'm a high value-added teacher. And if it's very negative, we'd say I'm a low value-added teacher. Okay, so that's a rough description. There are more complicated statistical details in the background in terms of what people actually do. But roughly, that's the concept that people are trying to capture. How much test score growth is there for a given teacher? So there's a really controversial debate in the US about whether these measures actually provide good measures of teacher quality. Should we be using these for teacher evaluation and so forth? It's been the subject of a lot of litigation and other policy debate. Now, in order to answer whether these measures are good measures of teacher quality, it's useful to step back and ask, as a scientist, what's the ideal experiment that you would run in order to determine whether this is a good proxy for teacher quality? So what I would want to do is, let's say you construct a bunch of measures of these value-added scores for teachers based on historical data. Then you'd want to run an experiment where you tell parents, look, we want to answer this really important question of whether teacher value-added matters. So we're going to randomly assign your children, some of them to low teachers we've identified as being low value added, some as high value added, and let's see how they do in 25 years. That's the kind of experiment you'd want to run. Now, you can imagine most parents don't want to participate in that sort of experiment, which is the challenge in empirical social science. So the power of large data sets, in my view, is that you can essentially find those types of experiments in the observational data that we already have. And so let me illustrate how we do that in this paper. We exploit the fact that there's a lot of turnover in school districts where, you know, in a given year, there might be a teacher who happens to be teaching a given grade, but then they go on maternity leave or they end up switching to a different grade or to a different school. And so there's a lot of variation in the set of teachers in a given grade across cohorts. And that variation is essentially random from the perspective of a student. It's hard to imagine that you select a given school because you know there's going to be a seventh grade teacher, you know, and when you get there, as opposed to in the next year and so on. And so to show you how we exploit that variation, again, I'm just going to describe this in the context of a simple example. Let's imagine that we track a given school in New York City over time, and we look at kids who get to fourth grade in different school years. So these are kids born in different years, right? They're in different birth cohorts. And so we're going to look at kids' average test scores in fourth grade in each of these school years, all right? So what you can see here is if you just look at test scores, you know, going across these school years, they're bouncing around the median on average, all right? So now what happens in this school is that at the end of the 1995 school year, there's a new teacher who comes in who's in the top 5% of the value-added distribution. So based on these prior data, we expect this teacher to be really high quality. So let's look at what happens to test scores when that new teacher comes in. You can see that test scores immediately jump up and they continue to remain high for subsequent cohorts of children. So now I'm describing this in the context of a single example. What we're actually doing here is looking at thousands of such events that occur in the data. That's the power of having the 20 years of data with 2.5 million kids, okay? So you can see test scores immediately jump up when the high value added teacher comes in, consistent with the idea that that teacher is actually improving students' outcomes. Now, as you all know, in any experiment, you want to have a treatment group where you change something, in this case, the better teacher coming in, but you also want to have a control group to make sure that nothing else changed at the same time that might be confounding your analysis. So in this case, you know, what's a natural control group? Since the better teacher came in fourth grade, you would expect that teacher should have no impact on test scores in third grade, right? Because they haven't taught the students yet. And so in fact, when you plot test scores in third grade, you can see that they are perfectly flat. There's no change in third grade test scores when the better teacher comes in fourth grade, which is, as you'd expect, very consistent with the idea that the teacher seems to have a positive causal effect. So I've emphasized in this particular example a very high quality teacher coming in and the positive impacts they have on student learning. This works perfectly symmetrically in the opposite direction. If you have this teacher here who doesn't want to be there, who's in the bottom 5% of the value-added distribution, they immediately pull down test scores as soon as they arrive relative to the prior grade. So it's perfectly symmetric across the distribution. Okay, so what we can then do now, tying this back to social mobility, right? So here I've just been showing you the impacts of teachers on test scores, which I think of as an intermediate proxy. We don't care about test scores in and of themselves. We care about kids doing well in the long run. So what we then do is repeat the analysis that I'm showing you here using the information from the tax returns on earnings, college attendance rates, things like that. And we document similar patterns. So rather than going through the details of that, I'm going to summarize what we find with a simple example, with a hypothetical policy exercise. Okay. So let's say we take the set of teachers we have, we estimate their value added, and we have the bell curve of teacher quality. Okay, and suppose we identify the teachers who are estimated to be in the bottom 5% of that distribution, highlighted here in the yellow. Okay, now a feasible policy that we could implement if we wanted to, in fact, some school districts in the US have started to do this, is take those teachers who are in the bottom 5% and either hire new teachers who would be of average quality, presumably, or give them training that brings them, let's say, up to the average quality level if you're able to figure out how to do that. So what impact would that have? So think about a policy exercise where we take out that lower tail and have teachers of average quality. Our estimates based on the analysis that I just showed you imply that if you replace a single teacher in a single grade of in the bottom 5% with a teacher of average quality, you would raise the lifetime earnings of a given child by $50,000. If you aggregate that over a classroom of average size in the US, which is 28 students, that's a $1.4 million return over the lifetime of kids taught by that teacher for a single year. You discount that back at a very generous 5% interest rate to present value to the point of the intervention, and that's worth about $250,000 in money today. Okay, and so the point here is that it's just a simple exercise to show you that teachers have quite substantial impacts on kids' long-term outcomes. A major issue in the US at the moment is that public schools really have no capacity to retain the best teachers or recruit the best teachers because salaries are set in a way that they're entirely a function of experience. So if you've got a really good teacher to whom you'd like to pay a bonus, they might have some other attractive career option, or they go teach at a private school or something, you basically have no way of giving them an incentive to stay. And so I think creating flexibility in these kinds of systems and trying to recruit and retain the best teachers can really have an important effect on social mobility, tying back to what we were talking about earlier. Okay, so I want to next turn to a slightly different set of issues. I've been emphasizing the role of neighborhoods, socioeconomic class, and schools. But I want to now show you a very different set of data that I think paints a more nuanced picture. So in particular, I want to emphasize that the factors that I've been talking about, neighborhood, environment, schools, and so on, are not the sole determinants of economic opportunity. There are substantial differences on other dimensions as well. And so I'm going to illustrate that by focusing on some recent work we've done looking at racial disparities in income mobility. So to start out, this chart here shows you how rates of income mobility vary by race in the United States. So what we're doing here is each dot represents 1% of the parent income distribution. So there are 100 dots here. Kids growing up in the lowest income families on the left, highest income families. So like the top 1% is the far right dot. Average incomes of $1.1 million per year for people in that top dot, okay? And we're showing on the vertical axis the average income percentile that where kids end up separately for white kids in the blue dots and black kids in the red dots. And you can see throughout the income distribution, black kids end up faring more poorly than white kids. You know, much to my surprise, you know, what I was most struck by when we did this plot is I had expected going into this project that you would see some convergence at the top of the distribution, that at some point race would become less important. If you're from a very high-income family, perhaps, you know, the black-white gap would be smaller. That turns out to be completely wrong. You can see that the gap at the top is almost exactly the same as the gap at the bottom. It's about 10 percentiles. And so what that means intuitively is that there are very high rates of downward mobility among black kids growing up in high-income families. So now, you know, 10 percentiles, is that a big difference? Is that a small difference? It's a little bit hard to get a feel for that. So I think a more intuitive and salient way to look at it is this chart here, which the New York Times put together using our data, which is a nice visualization of rates of downward mobility for Black versus white kids. So what we do here is take a set of kids who grew up in families in the top 20% of the income distribution. They grew up in relatively rich families. And we look at where they ended up in the income distribution, with purple dots represent Black men, green dots represent white men. And you can see the green dots tend to coast along at the top. If you're born to a rich white family, you tend to stay rich yourself. You'd stay in the top quintile or the second to top quintile. Whereas if you look at the purple dots, they come falling down at a very high rate. You know, a really troubling statistic is that Black men born to high-income families have very high odds, almost as high odds of ending up at the bottom of the income distribution as they do of remaining near the top of the income distribution, right? So there's really an incredibly high rate of downward mobility among Black men relative to white men, which I think is, you know, very disheartening. One way to think about it visually is if you think about the process of social mobility as climbing an income ladder for whites, it's more like being on a treadmill for Blacks, because generation after generation, even after you climb up, you tend to fall back down in the next generation. So the data I was just showing you, the previous chart and this chart, are for Black versus white men. If you now repeat this analysis for women, you see the pattern is very different. In fact, conditional on parental income, Black women have higher levels of earnings than white women. And so this phenomenon of differences in mobility and racial disparities in the US is entirely driven by men rather than women. Something you learn from these data that I think is least useful for thinking about how you might try to target these problems going forward. Now, you see equally sharp gaps in other outcomes. So if you look at incarceration rates, if you look at Black men growing up in the lowest income families, on a given day, the date of the 2010 census, 21% of Black men born to parents in the bottom 1% of the income distribution are incarcerated. That's on a single day, right? So it's an astonishingly high rate for Black men growing up in low-income families. If you look at women, that's shown in the orange and green series down here, that's essentially not an issue. So these kinds of factors, I think, lead to very sharp gender by race disparities that lead to sharp inequalities in the US. So how does this relate to what I was talking about earlier on neighborhoods? So let me go back now to the maps that I started out with, where I was showing you the geography of upward mobility in the US. But I'm now going to repeat that analysis separately by race, for Black men on the left and white men on the right. Now, what's remarkable about these maps is they look like they're on two different scales, two different color scales, but they're actually on the same color scale. It's just that the very best places for Black men are worse than the very worst places for white men. So it's on a single scale, but the distributions are basically non-overlapping in terms of outcomes. So you take a place like Boston, which has the best outcome for low-income Black men, of one of the best outcomes of $24,000 a year, that is worse than the average earnings of white men who grew up in Atlanta, where they have some of the worst outcomes among white men, of $26,000 a year, right? So there's an astonishing disparity across essentially all geographic regions in the United States in rates of upward mobility by race. And so that's the sense in which I wanted to say that what I was showing you on neighborhoods earlier is by no means the only thing that we should be thinking about as we think about social mobility. Racial disparities in outcomes persist even within neighborhoods. That is, Black boys have lower chances of climbing the income ladder than white boys, even if they grow up on literally the same city block, go to the same school, are raised in two-parent families with comparable income, education, and wealth. These are sharp disparities that persist within the type of areas that we typically think about. And so, you know, you might wonder, okay, so what can you do about this? So you can still look at these data and ask, are there certain types of places that tend to have better outcomes for Black men, right? There's some variation in the data. And so what you tend to see, I'm summarizing briefly here in the interest of time, you find that places that have relatively low poverty rates, so what you might think of as good neighborhoods, good resources, good schools, and so forth, but also have two other critical factors. They have low levels of racial bias among whites. You can try to measure racial bias among whites. You see intuitively, places that have lower levels of implicit or explicit racial bias tend to have better outcomes for Black men. And then third, an intriguing pattern, places that have higher rates of father presence among Blacks tend to have better outcomes for Black men in particular. So if you're growing up in an area where a lot of Black kids are being raised in two-parent families, Black men tend to do better. Black women, there's no association between father presence and their outcomes. So that's consistent with the growing literature that the presence of male role models might be very important for men's long-term outcomes. So this gives you some sense of the types of things that might matter. Again, correlational, but motivates a set of interventions one might try to do in the context of providing mentoring or role models or resources to try to help Black kids thrive within a given area. The key message here is just putting Black and white kids in the same school, in the same place, you're not going to solve the problem just by that. You need to do more than that to address racial disparities. Let me quickly summarize one final piece of data that I think might be relevant for this audience in particular here at a business school. So I will go through this briefly. So everything I've been showing you so far on equality of opportunity, you know, the traditional argument for being interested in these things like racial differences and so forth is based on principles of justice. But I want to quickly show that you can take a very different perspective on this that shows us, I think, that all of us have a stake in these issues, which is that improving opportunities for upward mobility can also increase the size of the economic pie. And so to illustrate that, I'm going to focus on one particular pathway to upward mobility, which is innovation. So the way we do that is by linking the universe of patent records in the US to the tax data to study the lives of inventors in America, who ends up becoming an inventor in the United States. And so I'll show you a couple quick charts that summarize the key point here. So the first thing you can see is that your probability of becoming an inventor as measured by having a patent is very strongly related to your socioeconomic background. So kids who grew up in high-income families are much more likely to become inventors than kids who grew up in low-income families. Your odds of becoming an inventor are about 10 times higher if you happen to be born to parents in the top 1% of the income distribution relative to parents at the median. So the last point I want to make here on this is, you know, so one explanation for this sharp disparity is related to the things that I've been emphasizing in this talk, differences in environment, teachers, schools, resources, things like that. A different explanation, which you'd at least want to consider as a possibility from a scientific point of view, is that this is about intergenerational genetic transmission of ability. Presumably the people who reach the top 1% had to be talented to get there, and maybe that's why their own kids are more likely to be successful, more likely to become inventors, and so forth. So just to show you how you can start to get a sense of that, you can go back to the New York City school district data that I was talking about earlier and use test scores early on as a rough proxy for ability. So this is one example of the way that you can look at this. And so this chart here plots patent rates again on the vertical axis. This time, instead of versus parent income, it's against test scores, okay? And each dot here represents 5% of the test score distribution. And so you can see that these test scores have some predictive power. If you're below something like the 90th percentile of your third grade math class, your odds of going on to become an inventor are much, much lower than if you're at the top of your third grade math class. Okay, so that is an interesting pattern. How does it relate to what I was showing you earlier? I think the striking result is this. If you then split this data up, looking at kids who grew up in high income families, families in the top quintile of the income distribution, versus kids who grew up in low and middle income families, you see that that kick up at the top in terms of rates of innovation is only there for the kids who grew up in high income families, right? So in the orange, rather than the kids who grew up in the lower income families. So to put it differently, high scoring children are much more likely to become inventors if they are from high income families. Or a different way to think about it is this suggests that in the US, in order to become an inventor, you really need two things. You need to be smart in some sense as measured by your test scores, math test scores early in childhood, and you need to be from a rich family. And so you can see why, you know, from the perspective of equality of opportunity, you might be concerned about this. The idea here is it's not just that you will give kids from lower income backgrounds better chances of succeeding themselves, but you might get more innovation and more growth if you bring those low-income talented kids through the innovation pipeline and end up having them do something great. Okay, so skip some of this and end with this chart here. So I've shown you a series of results on differences in opportunity in the US and how potentially we can make some progress in trying to tackle these problems. I want to end by showing you from a historical perspective why I think thinking about these issues now is extremely important in the US, and I think this applies very likely in the UK as well. We don't have these data yet in the UK, but I suspect you have a similar pattern here. So what this chart is showing you is a different related way to think about economic mobility, which is what are your odds as a child of earning more than your parents did? If we measure both your earnings and your parents' earnings, let's say in your mid-30s and adjust for inflation, what fraction of kids do better than their parents did? And we're plotting that versus the year in which the child is born. And you can see that for kids born in the 1940s, in the middle of the last century, it was a virtual guarantee that you were going to achieve the American dream of moving up relative to your parents. Now, you can see what's happened. The American dream has basically faded over the past 50 years or so, where for kids born in the 1980s who are about age 30 today, it's essentially a coin flip as to whether you're going to do better than your parents. And so I think this trend, my sense is, really captures the frustration that many people in the US are expressing, reflected in the election outcome and so forth. And I think figuring out how to combat this trend, while it might seem like a, you know, large national phenomenon, how could any one person, one business, one area do something about it? The key message that I hope you take from the set of results I've shown you is that I think the origins of this broad national trend are at very local levels. They start from our schools, our neighborhoods, what's going on in terms of exposure to innovation, things like that. And those are things we can change in our own communities that then add up, I think, to a very different national picture. And my hope is with the type of data that we now have and these types of methods, we'll be able to, in a precise way, tackle these problems going forward. Thanks very much.
This was a London Business School Review podcast, bringing you fresh ideas and opinion from London Business School's experts. To listen and read more, visit www.london.edu/LBSR.